this Green Knight film also shows, it's the interior journey that's taking place simultaneously. And if you live the one out and ignore the other, or vice versa, you'll always be in the position of an unlived life. They both have to be lived out.
Hello, my name is Clay Boykin, and I am in search of the new compassionate male. I believe in the midst of these incredible times of change, a new compassionate male is emerging as the new archetype. And this podcast is intended to give voice to both men and women on the overarching topic of compassion consciousness in men. What does the new movie, The Green Knight, have to do with Moby Dick, or Chaco Canyon, or the sun and the moon, or even the cosmos? How do they relate to one another, and how do they relate to our world today? A couple of days ago, I had the chance to catch up with our friend Dennis Slattery. As usual, Dennis paints a fascinating picture. So let's catch up with that conversation.
Well, okay, yeah. So I need to know about The Green Knight. And you were just telling me that you saw the movie.
Yeah, so and taught Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, the title of it. It's a chivalric epic. And yesterday, my copy of Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, translated by J.R.R. Tolkien in 1973, then edited by his third son, Chris. So the copy that came is a 2021 translation, a publication. And I started reading it this morning, and it just took me back into that medieval world of Arthur and the Round Table. And I wrote the film editor, Arlene, and asked her, what I want to do, I don't want to do a comparison, but I do want to dip in to see where Lowry, the director of the film, diverged from the original. But reading Tolkien's translation, and I opened it up and came in with my coffee and started to read it, and just what a joy. So, but I'm thinking about you with the men's group, because, and you're pointing a few minutes ago to leadership and the heart. Mm-hmm. There's so many beheadings that take place in the film. And I think my reading is this young, competent knight, who is the nephew of King Arthur, when the Green Knight comes in on his horse into the Round Table room where they're all ready to banquet, but Arthur says, "We can't start the feasting until I hear a good story about chivalry."
Yeah.
And right then, the Green Knight, who is just magnificent with branches and leaves, and he's a giant with an axe the size of a side of our wall here.
Yeah.
And he challenges any one of the knights to take one stroke at him, and whatever the outcome, and it's Christmas Day, 1 year hence, whoever steps forward to deal one blow to the Green Knight returns to the Green Chapel way deep in the dark woods to have one stroke meted out by the Green Knight. So the movie is that hero's journey into the dark forest, and he must go alone. And it is his individuation process as a man who moves his center of gravity from the head to the heart.
So Sir Gawain comes up and he cuts the Green Knight's head off.
And it flops on the ground, and the eyes of the Green Knight look up at him. And then the Green Knight picks up his head, gets back on his horse, doesn't put his head on. He picks up his head, he gets on, and he says, 365 days from now, Christmas Day, I'll see you at the chapel. And he rides out. And the film is so beautifully filmed. It's outrageously gorgeous.
I've heard that. Okay. So he goes out. Now, Sir Gawain's standing there pretty proud of himself, I guess.
And then as he goes deeper into the woods, he's naive.
Okay, so he's going to go into the woods to go
to the chapel. So he heads out plenty early enough, and he was smart to do it because he's waylaid by a number of forces that resist his journey and actually try to steal it from him.
Well, why would he want to go there for the knight to beat up on him?
Because he stepped forward almost like a knee jerk when the Green Knight said, uh-huh, this is my challenge. If there is one brave soul in here, I mean, he's calling the whole round table knighthood to task.
Okay, so Sir Gawain does that, and I think I answered my own question. He's an honorable man. That's why he goes to do the rest.
That's really good, because as the film shows it, he's an impetuous man, and in a knee jerk. See, this is why I want to see it again. Well, for a number of reasons, but does he do it to show off in front of the other knights? But you nailed the right term. It's a question of honor.
Right.
So he's like a pu'er at the beginning of the movie when he says, I'll do it. And then the knight says, step forward. It's like David and Goliath. And then, and I'm not going to spoil it for you, but I know the ending doesn't happen in the text, but I wanted to reread the text to get closer to the archetypal situations of the film. But for your men's working with the men, I just think this film could be used. And of course, Dana and Will had it.
And Dana and Will are the two that do the Myth Salon.
Exactly. They did last Thursday.
Right.
They did a full show on it. He just posted the show.
Okay, so the metaphor of the head getting cut off, and I was talking about earlier about leadership, and I was talking about Howard Teich,
yes,
the whole solar and lunar, you know, and
yes,
he, you know, and the in non-gender, but the solar is more the head energy, more than what
yes
we traditionally call male energy, and the heart is the lunar. Okay,
absolutely.
And his point is, a person has got to integrate both solar and lunar energy to be a complete person, both men and women.
Yes.
And we men are reaching in to embrace our lunar energy.
Yes.
As the women are reaching up to embrace the solar.
Yes.
And of course, we guys are fighting that, and we're resisting, but we're going down into the lunar thinking we've got to leave our solar behind, which
yes
is wrong. No, no, no. You're integrating that stuff.
Yeah. But and, it takes an act of courage.
It takes an act of courage. But then Howard said, he made the point in the podcast. He said, now, Clay, you know, the lunar leads and the solar executes.
Yeah.
Well, I kind of said, well, that's bullshit. And then
I'm writing that down.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I can hear.
Yeah. And so then I flash back to my time in the Marine Corps. And my God, he's right. Leadership that I learned and embraced in the Marine Corps is all heart. We certainly execute from the head, but we do not lead from the head.
No.
And you have to have both. You have to have both. And there's gray areas and all that stuff. But to make the point.
Yeah.
And it's a beautiful point, and it underscores why we men have got to do that. And what you're talking about with the Green Knight having his head cut off, I guess that's an opportunity for him to understand more of his lunar energy, perhaps.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, Dante understood this when in the Vita Nuova, when he described the sonnets that he was writing to Beatrice, he said, now I'm only going to read these or share these sonnets with women, not a male audience, because women understand intelletto de amore, that is the intelligence of love itself. See, that brings the head and the heart into a unity. That love has an intelligence, but it's here. It's the core. It's courage. It's a courtesy.
Right. And for those who haven't studied mythology, like me, before I studied mythology, I said, "Well, myth is a lie." Well, no, it's not.
Yeah.
What I'm learning, and you add to this, please. But mythology is how ancient wisdom is rolled forward, whether it be through our traditional mythology or through religious tradition.
Yes. Otherwise.
And those stories, that's our wisdom rolling forward. And of course, the beauty that Joseph Campbell did with it was, he said, all those stories have got the same storyline rolled into it pretty much. And he said, that's the hero's journey.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now I see that, and it's like, well, that's a blinding glimpse of the obvious. Everybody should know this. Well, not really.
Not really. No.
I'm learning it right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what a myth is a series of metaphors that give order and coherence to an individual life. Yeah. However, that takes content. That's your story. Right. But the bumper sticker that I would love to see on cars is, this is Campbell, metaphor is the native tongue of myth. It's the very language that myth uses to convey meaning.
I love that. Say that again.
Yeah. Myth. Metaphor is the native tongue of myth. Yeah.
I love that.
So stories are extended metaphors, or stories are metaphors with a plot line. You say it that way too.
Say it again.
Yeah. Metaphors are a story with a plot line. See, so there's a coherence to the narrative, and it is taking place as one moves in the world, but this Green Knight film also shows it's the interior journey that's taking place simultaneously. And if you live the one out and ignore the other, or vice versa, you'll always be in the position of an unlived life. They both have to be lived out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know the story? Do you know another thing I wanted to mention to you before I head out? I used to show this when I taught Campbell, and it's narrated by Robert Redford, and it's called, it's a 1 hour documentary called The Mystery of Chaco Canyon.
I know Chaco Canyon, but I don't know that.
And it, but I'm bringing it up because of your point. There was a sociologist, maybe in the 80s, and I used to know her name. She was visiting and not excavating, but exploring Chaco. And she, this was when Fajada Butte, you were allowed to climb it. Of course, many years ago, they stopped that because people were screwing around and spray painting and all the kind of crap. But I can hear her name in my head. She's a main character in the documentary. She's up at the top of Fajada Butte, and there's these big stone slabs. And in between is an opening. So the slabs are like this. And in between is an opening with this beautiful spiral
carved. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Okay.
It's spiraled.
It's a spiral.
Either inward or outward, however you want to look at it. Yes.
Exactly. And so she's up there. At the time, this is one of these synchronistic moments, when the sun comes through with a ray of light and creates a dagger of light at a particular place on the spiral. And she looks at that and she says, this isn't accidental. What the hell's going on here? Nobody had ever interpreted. So she started to, got permission and started to measure and discovered that that dagger of light over the period of 1 year or 2 years, and then I'm going to lose the details, but you'll get the spirit of it, moved across that spiral. And it was a clock. It was a cosmic clock. So she researches it and so forth. And then she gets this crazy idea. Oh, and then she measures the walls of a Chaco buildings, even extending out 2 or 3 miles from Chaco, and discovers that the sun moves along the walls like it moves along the spiral. So now she's starting to see this uniformity of purpose. And then she gets this notion, I wonder if the moon's light has any value or connection. So she starts measuring moonlight and discovers that the moon's light also falls along these architectural buildings. And she says, holy crap. She didn't say that, I'm saying it, but kind of excited for her. She said, what these Chacoans have done is brought the cosmos down into an architectural construction so that the sunlight and the moonlight mirror the movements of the cosmos. And she broke the mystery of Chaco wide open. And Campbell devotes 2 or 3 pages to it in one of his atlases of world mythology. And I didn't know that when I came across the documentary and started showing it to the students. And then I think one of them said, you know, Campbell does write about it. I said, where? And I bought the book and have it over here. But I'm thinking about, you know, your work with the men's group, that Chaco is an earthly mirror of the cosmic interplay of sunlight and moon glow or moon radiance, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's just, and can you imagine people living there who know that? So their work, they're moving around, living, cooking, hunting with this cosmic harmony around them all the time, reflecting the sky, reflecting the cosmos. It's just, it's magnificent. But I mean, I'm bringing it up.
Yeah, and that fits exactly what Howard's talking about in his book, Solar Light, Lunar Light.
Yeah.
And oh my God.
I think you could probably Google it or YouTube it. I've got the CD over here on the shelf somewhere, but I bet you could pull it up, and it's 55 or 60 minutes, no more.
Redford's
document. And Redford narrates it because he became fascinated. And they interviewed Native Americans about the history. And so it's history and myth coming together, cosmos, and, you know, very much a Rick Tarnas movement, cosmos and order. And it's brilliant.
You mean cosmos and psyche?
Psyche, yeah. He has a wonderful chapter on Moby Dick in there, too.
Oh, he does.
He does. I remember reading it, and then I reread it about three mornings ago.
I haven't got past the first 100 pages.
Because you're a marker.
I'm reading it like this.
Good.
I mean, I just keep going. It's so beautifully written, and it's so packed with information and knowledge and wisdom.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten to the chapter on Moby Dick yet.
Oh, I went to it. I went to the index under Melville because he points out, and I don't know enough about cosmology, but he said the reason there is so much force and power in this epic is that Melville wrote it during this cycle of Saturn, Uranus,
and Pluto.
And Pluto, Uranus.
I could be right.
But it's there. But you can look up Melville in the index. But then go to the chapter on Moby Dick, because I took two or three pages of notes on it, and I was going to use it in Nantucket in October.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Keep going.
But I haven't read, I've read maybe 60 pages at the front end, those chapters, but I've, you know, and I have it right down in my, on the floor with a whole series of books that I know I'm needing to be able to put my hands on. And I decided I'm going to go back to Cosmos and Psyche now. Yeah.
The point, I looked it up because I put it in my journal. I drew it in there.
Okay.
And it's the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn.
Yes.
And then Pluto's there. But they are square to Uranus.
Yes.
And so
Jupiter, Saturn. Okay.
And Jupiter, the generous leader associated with health, wealth, and having a good time.
Yes.
Saturn, strict responsibility and setting limits. Pluto, and this is kind of the wild card, regeneration, nature itself, transformation, rebirth, intense. And now those three are squared, which means it's coming in at a sharp angle with Uranus.
Where are you reading
from? And Uranus is disruptive, erratic, revolutionary, and rebellious.
So, and Clay, where are you reading?
Well, these are my notes
from
Cosmos and Psyche.
Oh, okay. Look at that. Beautiful.
And now I want to read something here.
Okay.
Rick Tarnas. This is a time of volcanically intense evolutionary pressures for the radical reconfiguration of all life structures. I'm not sure if that came out of the book or if that's something that he said on my podcast.
Okay, that's right.
No, we've had him on twice.
Yeah, good.
And oh my gosh, it's, you know.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we've gone from the Green Knight to Solar Lunar.
Yeah.
Now we're at Chaco Canyon.
Not Chaco.
And Chaco Canyon has pointed us to the cosmos.
Yes.
Which is so beautifully written about in Cosmos and Psyche by Rick Tarnas.
Yeah. Okay.
Let's sail back to Moby Dick while we're boiling the ocean here. So you were going to go up to Nantucket and y'all were going to do a study, or you may still be doing it, depending on COVID. Moby Dick. And you were drawing some analogies, parallels with how the story goes and how
yes. it
speaks to what's happening in the world today. And I'd love for you to talk about it uncut and uncensored.
When?
Now.
Oh.
Now, if you can just, because what you said earlier was before we went live, you were telling me this wonderful story and about who Moby Dick represents and how all the parallels with what's happening in the world today.
Yeah. So, okay. Let me pick up a thread here. You know, what's fascinating me several on this read of Moby Dick is the, because we're living in the atmosphere of it every day now, is the power to create in a mass of people a belief based on a fantasy, not facts, not facticity. And this is Ahab playing the victim. That whale dismasted me in the Sea of Japan. And I believe that it is, and he gives this speech on the quarterdeck. He says, I don't care if the white whale is the agent of evil or the principle of evil. I will strike through the mask and slay it. And the mask is that curtain separating the phenomenal world from the world of metaphysics, from ontology, from the invisible presences. And see, this is part of what's going on today. If I'm going to make some connections here,
yeah,
that there is this rage to get people to believe in what is both invisible and unreal. And Trump played the victim card in getting people to buy into this was stolen from me. I'm aggrieved. I'm wounded. And you need to make this right. The people that gathered on January 6th is the crew of the Pequod.
And the Pequod was Ahab's ship.
Ahab's ship.
And Ahab was the captain of the ship, and Ahab was after Moby Dick.
Yes. And
okay.
the Pequot people were almost extinguished completely during the massacres when our wonderful Federation was assassinating Native American tribes across the country.
Mm-hmm.
They are thriving now in New England because of casinos. So they're a healthy tribe now. But it's interesting that the ship that all of these men are on, which is made in part by parts of whales, whale bones and teeth, and it's the Pequod is half whale, half whale ship, partly a container for the world. It's a microcosm for the world.
Okay.
And this lie is perpetrated through superstition, through a fear of Ahab himself. And to entice, he nails a gold doubloon to the mainmast when he has the entire crew gathered on the quarterdeck. Quite a piece of change at that time. And it's from Quito, Ecuador. The doubloon.
Mm-hmm.
The first man who sights the white whale, that doubloon is his. So he puts an economic stimulus. and they buy into it. So this is Melville showing, this is my read, how an entire people, like the black people, can be demonized by a belief that they are not, they don't measure up to what is called a human being. So of course they can be enslaved because they're essentially animals. They're brutes. So my intention, and there are passages in Moby Dick in which I'll send the op-ed piece to you, where Melville says, you know, there are individual bad people, but democracy creates an ideal of a human being. And he says, I see it in common people. The guy that swings a pickaxe, building the railroad, or somebody shoveling coal. He said, this is where God and the nobility of human beings is seen, in the common person, not in the ones that are running the government.
And this is Melville speaking.
Yeah, this is
Moby Dick speaking. Okay.
Yeah, this is Ishmael. Because he narrates it, I defer to him.
Okay. But,
and he says, this is the great God Almighty who's democratic. He wants a sense of equity and justice to permeate all of human beings, not just in America, but across the globe. I mean, this was a vision in 1851 that was so radical. I mean, I think he sold, you know, a couple of hundred copies of Moby Dick. Nobody was reading it. It took about 85 years for critics to trip across it and said, what the hell is this? Where has this been hiding? See, America wasn't ready for Moby Dick. It wasn't ready for Melville. So that's the analogy that I want to develop, that the attack on the Capitol is the attempt to assassinate democracy itself, and that's our white whale.
So democracy was Moby Dick.
Yes. Yes. And, you know,
Now I haven't read Moby Dick. My perception was that Moby Dick was the bad guy.
According to the dismembered imagination of Ahab and the wounded imagination of Ahab, that's what it is. But then, Clay, towards the end of the novel, there are three sightings of Moby Dick. And the chapters are called First Day, Second Day, Third Day. On the third day, he shatters the Pequod. But the first day, when the white whale doesn't breach but surfaces, the language is that a god has just appeared out of the depths. Hmm. So here's Ahab's facetious reality of Moby Dick. And then here is Ishmael seeing it and describing it. And we have two different galaxies functioning. Yeah.
Wow.
So it's just, but Rick really helped me understand on a cosmic energy level how that work has so much force and energy in it, because part of it's planetary, which I don't pretend to understand, but I trust Rick, and so I just try to follow his argument.
Right. Oh, gosh, how fascinating this is.
Oh, it is. And Jung himself, I want to share this with you. At the beginning of a chapter called Psychology and Literature, which is in volume 15, called The Spirit and Man, Art and Literature, Jung's making a distinction between visionary fiction and psychological fiction. And he lays out several points of each. And then he says, I count Moby Dick the greatest American visionary fiction. It's right at the top. So my fantasy is, because in the collected works, I've not found Jung speaking about it, but I bet in the vaults in Zurich, where Shyam Dasani has said, there could be 6 or 8 or 9 more volumes of Jung's work. So that I think he said it'll take 30 years to create the complete works of Jung, not the collected works. And my fantasy is that somewhere in there, he has written about Moby Dick. Because Jung wouldn't just say that off the cuff, that this is the greatest American visionary novel or fiction that we have.
I wonder if James Hillman ran across that. You know,
good question.
In his access to study.
Yeah, good question.
I'm just beginning to learn about Hillman.
Yeah.
Fascinating person he is, or he was.
Oh, yeah. He really extended Jung's writing and, of course, took over as director of the Jung Institute in Zurich and wrote Revisioning Psychology at Aranos. And it was published in 75. Yeah, 75. But Hillman understands the poetic imagination like few writers I've ever read. He's brilliant.
I've just started reading that book.
Yeah, Revisioning. Yeah.
Now, okay, I'm going to make another shift.
And then I've got to run.
Okay, but we're talking, I really want to hit this one.
Okay.
You have a new book out.
Yes, it was just published a week ago.
I want to hear about it.
Well,
please. First of all, what's the title of the book?
Yeah, so it's the Way of Myth, Stories, Subtle Wisdom. Mm-hmm. So it's two parts. There are lengthy essays in the first part, some on film, some on books, two long chapters on Campbell. The second part is comprised primarily of blogs and op-ed pieces that I've written over the years and decided I wanted to gather them all up in the same place. And it's big, Clay. It's 325 pages. Yeah, so it's a hefty one. And my publisher, Mandorla Books, owned by Jennifer Seeley, she did a magnificent job of designing it. And yeah, so it was just posted on Amazon, I don't know, 4 days, 5 days ago.
Well, I'll certainly include it in the podcast, in the notes on the podcast.
Oh, do. Thank you for that.
Absolutely. Thank you. And I can't wait to get a copy of it.
Yeah. So, you know what, when it comes in and I mail it to you, I'll just send you an email just to watch for it.
Thank you. Dennis Patrick Slattery, I love every time we talk. And every time we talk, I think we could go on for another 8 hours.
I do too. And that's the best time to pull it to a close because we've got juice for the next outing.
We do.
If you or someone you know has something to share about men and compassion, write me directly at clay@clayboykin.com. Or visit the website, newcompassionatemail.com. Thank you.